And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon the case that may be. Welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight, that magical time between dusk and dawn when we send out transmissions into the solar system and across the galaxy, and someone answers. The only problem is, we can't tell you exactly who it was yet. We are, as they say, working on it. We have top men. Remember that great line from Indiana Jones? We have top men working on it. And in fact, they are top men, and you're going to meet some of them tonight. Before we get to this extraordinary experiment that we are in the middle of, actually, no, that's a misstatement. We are at the very beginning of something extraordinary. And after I go through a couple of interesting news items, I'm going to kind of recap for new listeners, because we have new listeners all the time. As my friend in radio used to say, jumping in and out of the wheelbarrow like frogs. Isn't that an awful simile? Anyway, I will get to kind of how we got to where we are tonight momentarily, but let me give you some really interesting news. Today is a red letter day, not only for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, but for all the rest of us. Today is the 14th tetrahedral day, literally to the day, since the Webb Space Telescope was launched on Christmas morning, talk about a present, at 7:20 a.m. Eastern Time, 5:20 a.m. my time. You can imagine where I was then, obviously watching. From French Guiana, middle of a rainforest, it's been in orbit en route to the L2 position. And if you don't know about L2, you will momentarily, for the last 14 days. Well, 14 days they've been in transit. They're about 600,000 miles away from Earth, roughly twice the distance to the moon, actually somewhat more. And they're aiming for a region of space, not a point, but a region, called the L2 region. A French celestial mechanics astronomer several centuries ago named Lagrange figured out, calculated that there are 5 stable points, give or take, in a given two-body system with one object orbiting around another. And they're labeled L1, L2, L3, you know, Lagrange 1, Lagrange 2, that kind of thing. Two of them are very stable, L4 and L5. Those are the ones that are ahead of and behind at 60 degrees an object orbiting, like the Earth. You know, they're 60 degrees ahead of the Earth's orbit and 6 degrees behind the Earth's orbit in the Earth's orbit, and they're not points. They're actually regions where something will kind of orbit around because of other disturbing factors. The solar system is more than two objects, right? Right. The other 3 points, L1, L2, and L3, are unstable, meaning that you can put an object there and it will orbit for a time, but it will kind of wander away eventually. So what you do if you want to put a spacecraft at these positions, these Lagrange points, is you give them fuel and you give them thrusters, and every once in a while they make a little correction and they kind of nudge themselves so their orbit doesn't take very much at all, just a tiny little nudge to keep them kind of orbiting those, quote, points in space. Again, in the plane of the Earth's orbit around the sun, because we're talking about the Earth-Sun system. The L2 point is about 1,000,000 miles behind the Earth, away from the sun, 1,000,000 miles out. It's not in the shadow of the Earth because, you have to be really exactly aligned to be in the shadow at 1,000,000 miles. I mean, can you imagine how small the Earth would appear at 1,000,000 miles? That's about 4 times the distance of the Earth-Moon. The Earth-Moon, the Earth from Moon some tens about 2 degrees. So the Earth from the L2 point, if you look back toward the sun, would be 1 degree. So if the Earth passes 1 degree above the disk of the sun, which again is a quarter the size that it would appear. I'm sorry. It's about the same size, about half a degree as it would appear from the moon, because a million miles on this scale means nothing. You can see that even slight orbital inclinational differences, because the orbit around the L2 point is not in plane. It will be out of plane sometimes. So the idea of going into an eclipse is rare, and usually only occurs, you know, around the equinox, roughly twice a year. Anyway, all of this celestial mechanics means that they're almost like 70-some% of the way to the L2 point. And over the last 14 days, as the spacecraft has been cruising uphill, slowing down, it's moving tonight at about 4/10 of a kilometer per second, which is about, what, 1.16, less than 2/10 of a mile per second, which is fast on Earth and very slow in space. And by the end of the month, by like the 23rd, 24th, somewhere around there, it will arrive on station. It will arrive at the L2 region, and they will fire thrusters, given the onboard fuel situation, which is really good. I mean, they got such perfection out of the Ariane launch vehicle that they said this afternoon, the project director said this afternoon in a NASA briefing, which is what I was watching most of the afternoon, and I'll tell you why in a moment. He said that they've got enough fuel on board, barring any unexpected radical emergencies, to literally last them, wait for it, 20 years. In other words, if nothing goes to the telescope, visits it, like Hubble was visited by the shuttle in low Earth orbit, that telescope can now function, barring electronic failures, for 20 years, given the onboard fuel that's required to give these little nudges every once in a while to keep it very happily and peacefully orbiting the L2 point. So why is today important? Well, today, the 14th tetrahedral day after launch, and you know where that number comes from. You know, there are 7 symmetry spins of a tetrahedron. If you have 2 of them, that's 14. It's also symbolically encoded in the dismemberment of Osiris, the 14 pieces that Isis had to put back together to reconstitute him after he'd been torn asunder in Egyptian mythology. I mean, all these hyperdimensional numbers are encoded in the myths. We'll get back to the transmissions that we did with some of these numbers shortly. So anyway, on this 14th tetrahedral day, the Webb Space Telescope people, the NASA people at NASA Goddard, my old alma mater, finished what is called the major elements of the commissioning of the Webb Space Telescope. What do I mean by that? Well, as you know, they had to launch this thing all folded up like a folded-up praying mantis inside the nose cone, i.e. fairing, of an Ariane 2 heavy launch vehicle rocket. And it's a huge telescope when it's all unfolded and deployed and unfurled and everything is out there the way it should be for it to operate as a functional observatory in space. So the last 2 weeks, the last 14 days, have been spent in deploying various aspects of the telescope, which had to all be perfectly 100% deployed for this thing to function. And the 3 major elements that had to, without fail, work, otherwise the whole mission would be a $10 billion catastrophe. That's how much this telescope, probably the most expensive spacecraft apart from the Apollo program itself, which in $1969 dollars was like $20 billion and would be probably more like $30 now in inflated dollars. The single most expensive machine the humans have ever launched into space as a single spacecraft is the Webb telescope. Why is it so expensive? Because they had to spend decades, literally almost 25 years, a quarter of a century designing it, learning how to make various parts of it, machining them, testing them, throwing away the failures, going back to the drawing board, doing all kinds of incredible testing in vacuum chambers and cryogenic rooms. And I mean, the degree of testing of this mechanical Rube Goldberg type device. For you who do not know who Rube Goldberg was, Google is your friend. Be prepared to be shocked when you read out about Rube Goldberg. Anyway, the most complicated part of unfurling this thing after it was launched like a butterfly out of a chrysalis, the nose cone, the fairing, was the five layers of Kevlar plastic aluminized film that extended out to about the area of a tennis court, all on booms, cables, and wires, and pulleys, and motors, and I mean an incredible complex nightmare, a spider web of mechanical things, all of which could go wrong, that kind of thing. And in 14 days, they not only successfully, a few days ago, finished deployment of this tennis court-sized multiple layer, five-layer Kevlar shield, which will protect the telescope and the electronics and the sensors, the cameras, the spectrometers, the super, super cold by necessity instrumentation that'll do the actual observing from the sun, even just a million miles further away from the sun than the Earth is. And it's pretty hot here, you know. That's why you have nice summer days. And even here in the Land of Enchantment, nice winter days. It was up to almost 60 degrees this afternoon here in the Land of Enchantment in winter in January, which was really nice. Anyway, all this incredible mechanical complexity worked perfectly the first time, and that huge tennis court size multiple layer sun shield was successfully deployed several days ago. The next thing that had to be deployed was the two elements on the side, they called them wings, of the 18-segment hexagonal mirrors. Three on each wing, that makes six, to be added to the ones in the center that were, you know, narrow enough to fit inside the, you know, rocket's nose cone, i.e. fairing. Those all had to be deployed and then locked into place. The boom, the three carbon fiber booms, had to be unfurled and locked into place, again by motors, so that the secondary mirror, which sticks out in front of this tripod carbon fiber tube arrangement, like three soda straws meeting at a point above the mirror, that had to be deployed. All of this to make the beginnings of a functioning telescope a million miles behind the Earth in space, behind a sun shield, where the differential between the temperatures on the sun side of the telescope, below the shield, you know, the electronics that need to be kept warm, and the telescope itself, which is the mirrors and the secondary mirrors and the instruments and all that, which are on the night side of the sun shield, that have to be kept really, 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 really cold, like only 50 degrees above absolute zero. They're like minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit when they get down to temperatures. The differential between the sun side temps and the night side temps for this telescope, as it's now deployed and moving again through space at about 0.16 miles per second toward the L2 point, is over 600 degrees between the day side and the night side. I mean, this machine is the most superlative, most complex, most expensive, most incredibly efficient when it gets going, when it starts actually functioning as an observatory, machine humankind has ever created, bar none, because it's going to literally see back to the beginning of time, like 100 million years or give or take, right after the Big Bang, and all the really cool stuff that happened very quickly in the early universe time frame. And the list of what it's going to reveal and confirm and boggle our mind with in terms of things that we have no idea are out there to be noticed and discovered and observed, just like with Hubble, it's all about to function. Now, what's going to happen next? Well, for the next several months, now that they've got the primary mirror all in one set of 18 hexagonal mirrors, each of those mirrors is a telescope by itself. And what they literally will do is they will use more motors on the backside of those mirrors to literally tilt and pan them. So instead of being aimed all over the sky, which they pretty much are now because they had to survive the rigors and the vibrations of launch and, you know, the mechanical tolerances of latches and screws and hold down clamps and all that. Once they use those motors on the backside of those 18 mirrors to drive them in X and Y axes, and then to use a motor in the center to change the focus of each sub mirror, the ultimate aim is to have all 18 mirrors functioning together as one giant integrated 22-foot-wide mirror. I mean, the 200-inch telescope on Mount Wilson is only, I think, about 8 feet wide, I think. I don't have a calculator down here, so 200 inches divided by 12. Tell me what that is. Okay. It's not very big compared to the web. And it was never designed to function at 400 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. It's going to take them literally tweaking and taking images in the infrared with the cameras, then tweaking some more. This is a very complicated, very elaborate, very time-consuming trial and error process. But the hard part, the what we would call the show-stopping part, the part where if that didn't work, you didn't have a telescope, that part is behind us. The sun shield is deployed and tensioned. The secondary mirror is out front. The main elements have been, moved around from the side to the front, locked into place. Now it's all about the fine tuning, and that will go on for several months. And then in about the end of the 6-month period, which is about 5.5 months from now, given that we're 2 weeks after launch, there will be a telescope, and they're going to try to blow our socks off by taking some pictures of stunning things that humans have never had the capability of looking at or imaging or sampling in terms of spectroscopic data ever, ever before. And they are going to blow our minds because the universe is, as Uhura said once, it's a big galaxy, Mr. Scott. Well, this is only one galaxy with about 500 billion stars. There are trillions of galaxies visible to this telescope, literally trillions. And they'll be able to eavesdrop on planets and detect planets where, as they orbit other stars, there are chemicals in the atmosphere that, like in Earth's atmosphere, are indicative of some kind of photosynthetic life. All of this is coming to a head in the next 5.5 months. So in about 5.5 months, which is what, June, July, somewhere around there, we should prepare to see some amazing imagery and some equally amazing explanations. So if you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, That's our website, theothersideofmidnight.com. That will take you to the guest page tonight with our banner, which says very mysteriously, Oumuamua or Someone Answers, because that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. What we've learned so far, we've learned a little bit more tonight, and you're going to hear that, and what we need to do next to learn more. Click on that banner. That will take you to the guest page. Under there, you'll see where it says fast links to items under to listen to the show under the guest page banner. Click on my items. That takes you to item number one. This is an up-to-date web blog that's updated sometimes twice, three times a day, and sometimes only once a day. But kind of save that link and then just refresh, and that will tell you where they are in the fine-tuning of the mirrors to make one super 22-foot-wide primary mirror of the biggest telescope by far ever put into space, and one of the biggest telescopes that humankind has ever created, either on the ground or in space. Okay, item number two, this is a link directly to where is the telescope. This shows you graphically how far it is away from the L2 point, and when they get there, they'll change the graphics, and you'll be able to follow its orbit around and updates, temperatures, things like that. Number three, this is very interesting. Item number three. In the last few weeks, NASA has done some very, very curious things, kind of like Webb is the beginning of an orchestral overture, which is designed to prepare us for a whole new view of the universe and our place in it, and maybe some other people's place in it. And this story is really rather remarkable, because it actually documents that in the last few weeks, NASA has reached out to a group of something like 24 theologians at various institutions, religious institutions, and academic institutions around the world. And they basically asked them to study human reactions to an official announcement that there are, wait for it, aliens. I mean, does this kind of remind anyone of Brookings? It sure does to me. The timing, of course, remember, while this is all going on with our favorite local neighborhood space agency, the Department of Defense, under the latest NDAA, National Defense and Authorization Act, which is the annual appropriation and authorization of funds for the Department of Defense, almost $1 trillion spent on weapons. In this DOD bureaucracy, this vast, overwhelming bureaucracy, they have set up a new office, a new department, which reports directly to the Secretary of Defense, who in turn reports directly to the President of the United States. And what is that office? Well, it's an office designed to study, research, and report to the Congress, and someday to people, on UFOs. In other words, since we know there are no terrestrial UFOs, come on. On aliens. Now, do you think these two separate developments are truly separate? Because if you do, I have a bridge in Arizona that I can sell you real cheap. No, of course they're not. This is part of an integrated plan. From all the indications that we have, and we're going to be talking to a very interesting person tomorrow night on the Sunday show named Paul Wallace, who has written a stunning book called The Scars of Eden, which is going to track potentially our interaction with aliens going back millennia with some really interesting documented evidence. Anyway, all of this is coming to a head now because from all these separate disparate trend curves, I and some of my colleagues are projecting that 2022, I love that alliteration, 2022, is going to be the year that we again, the again is in parentheses, that we again make contact. In other words, that's when they're going to tell us that we, in fact, are not alone. And that's why they are reaching out to theologians to to try to tell them as a government bureaucracy, i.e. NASA, how people might react. Well, they could have saved some money, because there's no way that a poll is going to tell you what the most monumental modern rediscovery in human history is going to do to people until you go through the monumental rediscovery of what history does to people. Polls will not tell you in the abstract, in the academic, how people will respond, because they respond at one level when asked a question, and they respond at a very different visceral level when confronted with the actual evidence. And I probably should modify that, because based on our year, well, 2 years now and change of experience with COVID-19, I think a large percentage of people on Earth, if and when official governments say we are not alone, that a large percentage of people will completely, totally ignore that announcement, either because they already think they know what being not alone in the universe means, i.e. from their religious perspectives, or B, they will so have distrusted government over the last 10, 20, 30 years, which at so many levels has demonstrably lied to them, that when government says we're not alone, they'll say, yeah, and whose grandmother says that? In other words, they will not believe the official announcements, regardless of how high in government it comes from. And that will present some interesting problems and potential opportunities, which of course brings us to what we're doing here tonight on the other side of midnight. Because, as you know, starting back in December of last year, we literally tried an experiment that had never been tried before. We tried to actually communicate with an extraterrestrial object, the first known interstellar visitor to the solar system, which whipped through the solar system in 2017 and sent us, in response to our communication, something which sounded a lot like this. When we come back, we're going to bring on members of our Oumuamua team. We're going to talk about what we have received, what we've been able to decode, and where do we go next. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
The other side of midnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcasters to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
Welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight. No, that's not our transmissions, and that's not our reception. That is from Close Encounters of the Third Kind, a 1977 movie, which eerily depicted that maybe the most likely way to get a response from interstellar occupants, from extraterrestrials, was to send tones, to send frequencies, to send harmonics, to send fundamental mathematics and geometry, which basically is the basis of the construction of 3D reality itself.
Somebody's taking all this down.
What are we saying to each other?
Seems they're trying to teach us a basic tonal vocabulary. It's the first day of school, fellas. Take everything from the ladies. All of her pattern notes.
Anyway, welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight for this Saturday night, January 8th, 2022. The day the web has now been successfully almost commissioned. There's a lot of work ahead, but nothing is a showstopper. There's multiple backups, multiple motors. These little motors are going to twist and tweak and re-aim and point the 18 sub-mirrors, but that's a very relaxed process compared to the perils of unfolding that tennis court size sunshield. So, let me introduce, without further ado, our guest tonight. Not any particular order, because we don't have particular order around here. We have with us David Sarita, who is, of course, one of the prime investigators involved in our Enterprise Mission Oumuamua team. He is a polymath. He's been working with sacred sites, sacred numbers, sacred frequencies and sacred geometry literally for decades, and is basically, like most of the rest of us here, a generalist. We have John Womack, who, in addition to being a music producer and someone who is extraordinarily adept with computer programming and animations and graphics and videos, also is an experiencer in terms of personal contact with whoever might be out there, because he's been enjoying out-of-body experiences and communication with, I love this phrase from Michael Hill, those not from here, for many, many decades. And last but not least, we are joined tonight by I'm totally blanking on Tom's last name. It'll come to me momentarily. He joined us as a music producer, actually Emmy-nominated music producer, and his interest has also been in frequencies, sacred geometry. He lived for a time in Ecuador. He has visited many, many sacred sites. He actually wrote me an email some weeks ago saying, I might be able to help, send me some data, which we did, and thereby hangs a very interesting tale. So without further ado, I'm sorry, Tom, I'm completely blanking on your last name. And I think in part it's because you had a stage name, and I insisted rather stubbornly that we not use stage names tonight, that we represent to the scientific community our real names. So Mathers, yes, I knew it would come to me. So anyway, gentlemen, oh, and Ron Gerbron is with us, our resident generalist, and you basically all have heard Ron on the show many, many times before. So without further ado, welcome all to The Other Side of Midnight.
Hi, Richard.
Howdy.
That's hey, John. Richard.
That, I think, is Tom.
Hey, that was Thomas. Yep. And this is David Sarita. And
hi, David. And Ron is there somewhere in the background. Ron, are you with us? Oh, maybe his phone always acts up when we try to do a show. It's very curious. So, in fact, I don't see him in the lineup. So I guess we may have to call him back. Let me go to you, David. Why don't you kind of set up the background? How did we get to where we are tonight? You were working with a...
Now I'm unmuted.
Okay.
Yeah. That was a key thing.
Okay. David, you were working with a radio ham named Jimmy Blanchett, and I had you on like 6 weeks ago, something like that, and out of this developed the idea of sending through Blanchett's antenna at a power of something like 500,000 watts a dedicated message to Oumuamua, this object which came through the solar system in 2017, which a lot of the people, including the mainstream people like Avi Loeb at Harvard, have been championing for many, many years now as potentially an interstellar object of artificial origin. The only difference is that they listened, mainstream mega radio facilities, radio astronomy facilities, but nobody, at least publicly, until we thought of doing it, thought to transmit, certainly not on these particular frequencies. So why don't you start at the beginning and kind of unfold for people who are new what we said we would do, what we did, and some of the early returns.
Well, first of all, when I started working with Jimmy Blanchett, our first transmission was August 8th, 2021. We did a moon bounce, and we aligned the moon bounce between the antenna and the Great Pyramid of Egypt would be at the center of that moon bounce. And then we had a guy videotaping the Great Pyramid to determine if there was any response, if the pyramid's semiconductive and conductive properties would emit or vibrate with an energy. And sure enough, we ran the video he shot, his name is Syed, through an algorithm software, and you could see an enormous energy vibrational response, you know, pictographically, videographically, you can see what appears to be an aura coming off the pyramid. And that signal by, you know, when it left the earth, I mean, Jimmy's antenna, depending on angle, could produce up to 500,000 watts, but most of the transmissions are somewhere around 75,000 watts, you know, 100,000 watts, 250,000 watts in that region. But on a very low angle transmission, he could reach 500,000 watts. So what we have to determine now is, because there's another component in the responses we get, and, you know, while we're beckoning our universe, we're knocking on heaven's door. We've literally sent, actually, after my wife died, actually, August 9th, which is the anniversary of Nagasaki, actually. And we sent her musical recordings to Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, actually, as a form of knocking on heaven's door with encoded messages. So there are several ways that we transmit. We will send actual tones, just like the tonal dialoguing in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. We sent pictograms, which are generated by facsimile-type technology. When you scan an image on a fax machine, it's basically the same type of technology as that. You're converting an image, which including the type and pictures, into a sound wave, and the sound wave actually contains the picture. And then we also sent, of course, musical recordings and the human voice. So when we looked at our responses, the responses come in on these little, basically, ham radios that we are tuning the radio to the same frequency as the transmission. And here's what's really interesting is I want everyone to see this. Just get a piece of paper, draw a straight line. And imagine that straight line. The length of that line is an antenna. And this is what's really amazing about electromagnetism is the wavelength coming off of a monopole antenna is four times the height or the length of the antenna. So you're basically, the way electromagnetism works is a square. And it's not the same as squaring, because squaring means you take the number times itself to see how many square units fit in that square. But nevertheless, electromagnetism is, in response to an antenna, its wavelength is four times its height, which is a square. So imagine drawing infinite billions of squares.
Hang on. When you say a square, you mean four as in four sides to a square.
Right, as in four sides. Not squaring, no, but a square. Because the length of the four sides of the squares is equal to the length of the wavelength coming off of it. That's how electromagnetism works. And notice that Einstein's formula is E, energy is equal to mass times the speed of light squared. Speed of light squared is different than the four measurements of the side of the square. But the four measurements of the side of the square are proportional to squaring, actually. So in a way, the universe has this cubic infinite fabric, these little cubes. Now, if you look at what's called the crystal lattice scale of, for example, calcium, which is what your bones are made out of, on a crystal lattice scale, it's cubes with six pyramids inside the cube. So the very structure, in fact, gold is cubic centered as well, which means it's a cube with six pyramids inside the cube.
And a cube is a double tetrahedron.
Right, and a cube is a double tetrahedron. But what's amazing about what I'm telling you is this is the structure of not only electromagnetism and Einstein's formula equals mc squared, because squared and squares and cubes are all in this perfect mathematical proportion. That's how light and electromagnetism functions. It functions in the law of squares and cubes, actually, because Einstein's formula also goes to the speed of light cubed. Now, just I want you to see this, because not only is your body made of cubes and pyramids, so were our temples. The Holy of Holies in Solomon's temple, which at the time of Moses was called the tabernacle, was a cube, 10 by 10 by 10 cubits, and at the time of Solomon, 20 by 20 by 20 cubits. Now, here's what's amazing. The frequencies that we are working with are the royal cubit, as that monopole, that first line you drew on your paper, the wavelength is basically one royal cubit times four is the wavelength that we're operating at. Where all the frequencies that we're working with are proportional to cubits. And it seems that the universe may function on these little squares and cubes of cubits, and that this massively powerful antenna we're using may or may not even be necessary is what we're finding out with these little radios. So
yeah, hang on there, because I figured out now we're going through a new system, because we're transitioning from Kinthea to another way to work with the website and other people like Keith. And it took me a while to figure out how to get this transmission. But Jimmy sent me a video of our Christmas Eve transmissions. So what David just described, if you were on Oumuamua or anywhere in space between us and Oumuamua with the right radio and the right antenna, this is what you would have heard. Okay, this is background. This is what we actually sent many, many times over the last month. So go ahead, David.
So what I'm saying is, for example, if I was an extraterrestrial, and we know from the U.S. Navy reports that they're clearly admitting that these things are flying in our skies, and they're operating at functions of and basically that don't make sense for any aircraft or any physical mass object to be moving through or interdimensionally around our planet, because they're violating all the laws of physics. So the question is, how do they communicate with each other, right? And if I was an extraterrestrial, the first thing that would interest me would be our music, believe it or not, because music is I believe this, and I was talking to Thomas about this last night, is humanity's greatest achievement, because without music, we probably couldn't feel very many emotions. Because remember, music is the artistic expression of very specific frequencies that took millennia to get really nailed down into a beautiful harmonic series of music scales that we now use today. So what happens when we listen to music? We feel emotions. We feel like dancing. We feel like doing all kinds of fun things. Now imagine a world where there's no music at all. So I think some of these extraterrestrial civilizations are that flat and dead and dry. They have super, super duper intellects. They figured out how to go faster than light, but they can't dance. They can't feel anything. So they're attracted to our music.
I feel
first,
a movie coming on.
And I feel what's really funny to me is when I look at the response that we got, okay, we got, they sent us numerical values in these chirps on our radios with me holding up my frequency meter. They're blipping all these numbers at us. They sent us the speed of light. They sent us the Stonehenge, the coded number 56, which Maria Wheatley told us is Stonehenge number one with the 56 blue stones. They actually sent us the north latitude of the Great Pyramid, which I forgot to tell you, because that's one in the same as the speed of light in 10 base. They sent us the most perfect royal qubit there is, and a whole bunch of different qubits. What initially I thought were different qubits, and then I looked at the numbers again, and I said, this is a longitude and a latitude in 10 base.
Wait, we just made a huge, huge, huge leap. When did you go from frequencies and fundamental hyperdimensional constants to lat longs?
The way I went to lat longs is I've spent years looking at this concept that the latitude and longitudinal basically grid mapping of our planet actually exists in physics. Because if you watch the angular momentum of an electron around the nucleus of an atom, it goes longitudinal and latitudinal. It's going all over the place. It maps all longitudes and all latitudes. It does every single one of them. In less than 1 second, it's mapped a holographic sphere in less than a second. So that means longitudes and latitudes are real. They're not theoretical. And we also know from remote viewing that longitude and latitudes can give a remote viewer the ability to tune into a target without knowing what is at that location. And the question is, how does that function? So when I look at my radio spitting out all these numbers, I'm looking at these numbers, and I have – the way my brain works is numbers are like a language to me. I've calculated thousands of electromagnetic frequencies based on waveguides, which means a temple is actually like – the dimensions of a temple are actually like a waveguide. I literally decoded an entire music scale out of the dimensions of the Great Pyramid of Egypt, which is the most beautiful-sounding music scale I've ever heard. And I've been doing this stuff for years. And when Oumuamua was noted in the media to have gone through our solar system – and like you said, coming down at 33 degrees and coming within a ratio of 1 to 6.18, the golden ratio number, to an astronomical unit and the closest distance it came to Earth, I realized that this thing was functioning in some sort of a musical harmony, actually.
In other words, its trajectory was specifically designed to communicate these types of numbers and frequencies.
And frequencies are music. So try to think of frequencies as actual music. And then, of course, after all this data comes in, and I'm looking at all these other numbers, because there was more than just the speed of light, Stonehenge, the location of the Great Pyramid of Egypt, and the most perfect royal qubit, which resolves the height of the Great Pyramid to absolute perfection. It measures in the Dead Sea Scrolls temple scroll the innermost court of the Holy of Holies to perfection, and it resolves the remains of Noah's Ark found on Mount Ararat to absolute perfection, and all of which contains the golden ratio. So I started looking at these other numbers, and I'm saying these are longitude and latitudes in 10 base. So basically, longitude and latitudes are degrees, minutes, and seconds, but actually you can convert degrees, minutes, and seconds to degrees and digital degrees. So I could have 20.605 degrees north latitude, and then I could have a longitude. So what happened next is, of course, Thomas Mathers showed up, and he is a world-class musician who did this incredible electronica music career and did a song with Paul McCartney that got him nominated for an Emmy. And when I started talking to Thomas, I went, Thomas was sent to us. He's part of the response because the universe found him. And we spent hours talking to Thomas on the phone, and I realized he's part of the answer that was sent back to us, actually. And the function of music, see, what would beckon an ET response more? If I sent them a bunch of tones, or I sent them a pictogram, or I sent them music. Now, we know that we sent all three of those in our transmissions. In fact, we sent one of Michael Lee Hill's songs to Oumuamua as well, right? So the question is, which of the three triggered them? And their vast intelligence network, how did, of all the people, because we you know, of all the people that have responded, we connected with Thomas. And Thomas did this incredible song with Paul McCartney called 1985. And when you listen to it, you know, when I was listening to it with my really good stereo system here, my daughters were jumping around like jumping beans, having the time of their lives. Now, if I sent my daughters the tones, just the tones, they wouldn't be jumping around having the time of their lives. They'd just be sitting there going, what is this? Do, 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 do. You know what I mean? So consciousness seems to be activated by something emotional, something sensitive, something sensible, meaning it activates your senses and it makes you feel something. So that's basically, in a nutshell, where we're at. But I can tell you right now, I know that the longitude and the latitude repeated multiple times. So it's not random chance. And it's a specific location on the planet that this particular response came through on my radio. And I know where it is, but I'm not going to tell anybody tonight, that's for sure.
Well, we don't want the bad guys to zap in and pick up whatever could be there, but it could be anything from an ancient library, a time capsule meant for now, or it could be, you know, let's say an ancient abandoned spacecraft that's buried by natural forces somewhere under the ocean or on land somewhere.
See, that's an interesting thing you're saying there, because if I was an ancient civilization and I wanted to come visit Earth and I looked pretty much human, I would park my ship somewhere hidden on the Earth, somewhere remote, and then I would have it transmit all the time so that I could find it in case I forgot where I put it, right? So maybe all these transmissions we're getting on our radios
David, it's like that scene in Star Trek IV, remember? When Kirk gets out and he says, remember where we parked?
Exactly. It's funny, I was on the set of Star Trek and I met all those guys in person. Star Trek, the one with the whales, you know.
That was Star Trek IV.
Yeah, I was on the set of Star Trek IV. When my good friend Michael Thomas Mann got me on the set and I got to meet everybody. I met Leonard Nimoy a number of times and William Shatner a few times. So I think Thomas Mathers, also being a very creative mind, has shared with me some incredible insights about where we can go next. You know, and you and I, Richard, have been talking about your idea which is a brilliant idea, to set up our radios in multiple
sacred sites. Let's not give it away. You know, you've done the perfect segue.
David?
Thomas?
David? No, this is Ron.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay, Ron, go ahead.
Yeah, I just had one thought. You said it had sit your ship somewhere on an isolated spot and have it transmitting continuously. No, it would probably respond to a ping forever. You have to ping it, just like a computer.
Yeah, but that's what we're doing. We're pinging it. See,
well, exactly. That's what you're. That's your. That's
we're
what, yeah.
pinging it.
That's all.
Says, our radios don't do anything unless we ping. Like, so I've got my radio on right now. It's been on all last night and all day, and it hasn't done one thing because I haven't sent out one thing into it. And it's set at a new frequency, actually.
Okay.
And
over the last several days, I've had mine set at 4.144.1. It chatters away. I have to move it from the pyramid to the coffee table to by the couch to, you know, kind of activate it because it's very site-specific within inches. But as soon as I try to record it, as soon as I hook up the cable to the computer, it shuts off. It's like whoever's at the other end of the phone does not want to be recorded. The only successful recording I was able to do digitally by a wire was when we actually transmitted. So someone broadcast back to us on that frequency and everybody else shut up and I could record anything, anywhere. And that period has disappeared because we have not transmitted anything in like a week or two.
Right. But remember, we can transmit through our radios. And the question is...
Well, that's a whole
when
other conversation. Okay.
Yeah, when you consider the possibility that these radios are, again, we note that Nikola Tesla and Marconi, it was reported in Collier's Weekly, way back in the day of the time of Tesla and Marconi, that they were receiving the same type of little staticky blips on the radio systems they developed, and they thought they were extraterrestrials. They ruled out Morse code. So we know that what Jimmy Blanchett discovered is a rediscovery of what Tesla and Marconi experienced in the very foundational days in the birth of radio. So we also know that the God of Moses told him to put a copper fiery serpent, which is a coil, on a pole, which is actually what Tesla did when he built the first radios.
Okay, hold it there. Hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. My guest this morning is David Sarita, Jonathan Womack, Thomas Mathers, Ron Gerbron, Keith, of course. Keith Morgan is with us. And we shall return. We're talking about how do you talk to an ET. When David said someone that looks like us, remember, my model is that we're talking to us. We're talking to other members of the human family. And who would care more about human history, about ancient human history, than maybe members of the family? And as you heard David in the last half hour describe, the answers we have been getting are directly connected to us, to our own ancient history of ancient sacred sites around the world. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to this Saturday night, January 8th of 2022. Welcome to the other side of midnight. We're talking about communicating with extraterrestrials, or in my parlance, with lost and distant members of the family. So what I'd like to do is to come on with Thomas. Thomas Mathers, come on down.
Hi there.
Hi there. Okay, that's a big build-up for a very interesting guy. Why don't you give us a kind of a thumbnail sketch of who you are and how you got into this strange company with all the rest of us crazy people?
Well, I think it's sort of an interesting sequence of events. I've been a musician since I was a very small little guy, and was very lucky to make it a career, and a career which led me to travel all over the world. And throughout that time, I guess on a sort of more personal level, after some experiences in my early 20s, which I would just describe as high strangeness, it kind of opened up my mind and got me interested in sort of learning a little bit more about this and a little bit about that. And that kind of took me down the rabbit hole. And a lot of these kinds of topics that I found interest in ended up becoming sort of the basis for a lot of what I was doing with my music. I think, you know, as David sort of alluded to, you know, there's something very magical and special about music, and definitely when you're writing it and when you're producing it and you're sort of taking all of these frequencies and trying to turn them into a nice painting that's going to sort of tickle the brains of the people that are listening to them. It's a pretty deep process, at least for me, artistically, it was a very deep process. So, you know, I've been very interested in technology since I was a little kid. And because of that, you know, just got interested in a lot of different areas. So I think it was you, when we first sort of met, had sort of said that you're quite a generalist. And it was kind of a very interesting sequence of events as to how I even got that particular show when you guys were talking about this, some of the results and some of the transmissions that were received, was actually in a Telegram group, and somebody posted in the Telegram group that you were live and that you guys were basically talking to somebody out there. And when I saw that, I had to click on the link and go, this is crazy, and sort of did a little bit of a deeper dive. And then when I heard the transmissions, it really piqued my curiosity. And, you know, because I deal and I have developed over the years a very particular ear, and, you know, so when I'm taking a look at frequencies and when I'm taking a look at rhythms or the cadence of the human speech or things like that, it's just something that I kind of focus in and hone in on details. So there were some things, you know, that I was listening to that, you know, intrigued me. And, you know, you had sort of put a call out saying, hey, if there's anybody that, you know, thinks that they could, you know, sort of assist in any ways to reach out. And, you know, one of the first times I've ever just randomly sent an email out and was very surprised to have a phone call from you in the middle of the afternoon. I think it was on a Saturday or a Sunday or something. So, but in the subsequent conversations, I think, you know, we've all seen that we have this really deep desire to sort of, you know, see if there's something out there. And, you know, I think, you know, the one of the areas that I've been really interested in and have been applying things into my music was specifically sacred frequencies. You know, concentrating on like the vibrations of like the holographic structure of like the ether of this reality.
Okay, let me ask a very dumb question. What differentiates a sacred frequency from a frequency?
Well, I think that the sacred frequencies basically can create, they can kind of vibrate and create sort of like an amplitude. How would I sort of explain this? But the amplitude would sort of multiply. Like the only way that I can kind of try to explain it would be, you know, when, you know, as somebody, I've been meditating, you know, almost daily for, you know, probably around 7 or 8 years. And, you know, one of the things that I've found through meditation is really concentrating on sort of the vibrations. So, you know, there comes a point when, you know, like when you're kind of vibrating where you can kind of sort of feel this like amplification where the signal kind of gets more and more intense and more intense. So kind of like a feedback loop. So I think that some of the sacred frequencies are basically, you know, having a physical or, I mean, that's kind of another thing, but it's having an effect on the actual geometric structure of the holographic ether. And this is at least my interpretation or my belief. And it's, you know, how I've sort of in the last couple of years have looked at sort of visualizing it. So, you know, obviously if you are right in tune in a specific frequency, you know, you're going to vibrate that medium more than something that is, you know, not, you know, sort of synchronizing with that geometric structure.
It would be a frequency to which humans, i.e. our consciousness, our bodies, our personas resonate to, which just kind of happened to turn out to be the same frequencies that are critically important in the hyperdimensional physics model. In other words, these are frequencies which are part of the substrate of reality itself.
Well, so, I mean, you know, I think, you know, the way that I've always interpreted it is that, you know, in certain literatures, when you're talking about oneness and that everybody's connected, well, you know, we're connected because we're basically, you know, all comprised of the same fabric and we're resonating and we're vibrating. And it's the vibrations, I believe, you know, that sort of materialize different, you know, whether it's an atom or whether it's an electron or, you know, anything, you know, all the way up to larger, you know, multi, you know, like a human being or, you know, a planet or a star or something, right? Mm. So, I mean, as a musician, I think there's something absolutely beautiful about the idea that the universe is basically just like a gigantic, you know, like probably more than three dimensions, but like a multidimensional lake. And you've got all of these different droplets, you know, kind of vibrating, and the vibrations are basically, you know, what we perceive as being, you know, of substance in the universe. So
with nodal, you know, points and resonances and patterns.
Well, exactly. So if we take a look at, interference patterns or things like that, you know, you're going to have points in space. You're going to have points on a planet. You're going to have points, you know, on your body, you know, that, you know, are conduits to sort of vibrate this sort of ether. You know, and that was, you know, these have sort of led into some of the conversations that I've had with you and David, you know, in terms of, you know, that there is does seem to be more than just some type of a radio frequency. The radio frequency is kind of establishing the intention. The fact that there's these that we're broadcasting an awareness of certain important numerical structures that, you know, as difficult as they are to, I think, define. And, you know, I think that we're sort of living right now through a moment where, you know, there seems to be a lot of disciplines that are starting to sort of intersect. So, you know, and that's in my personal life is where I became very interested in sort of the intersection of sort of metaphysics and then the physical nature of reality and trying to understand what that connection is. And, you know, I had been drawn to sacred sites, you know, through my travels with my music. I've been able to visit sacred sites all over the world. I've spent a tremendous amount of time. I lived in South America almost for 5 years. And whenever I went to these sites, you know, would sort of collect rocks and meditate and do things. And, you know, it's, you know, for me, and I've had these conversations with David so far, I come into this without having kind of formally ever studied under somebody to teach me how to meditate. A lot of this has been just kind of self-exploration. And I've done this, you know, coinciding with, you know, the development of my music. So that kind of was really what gravitated me, you know, into this. And I think that, you know, in our conversations, I sort of brought a little bit of a different perspective to things. And, you know, I do come from a very sort of logical background. So, you know, the interesting thing for me is to, you know, as we continue these attempts and we sort of build upon, you know, what you guys have so brilliantly started, you know, that we start incorporating different protocols, standardizations, and the methods of the, you know, basically incorporating some of the scientific method for us to really be able to kind of rule out, you know, are we picking up other signals? Is this some type of a, you know, technology failure, or are we picking up interference or whatever, you know, to sort of be a little, you know, play a little bit of the devil's advocate and be incorporating things into the, you know, the testing protocols to kind of eliminate some of those doubts. And then obviously, and this is, you know, very self-serving, you know, really wanted, you know, an opportunity to take a look at some of these sound frequency structures, you know, and try interpreting and analyzing them in different ways. And then I think, you know, sort of, you know, where I see things kind of developing right now. And, you know, I think as we kind of go along in the show, you know, we can sort of start, you know, breaking down a little bit what the, you know, sort of the next kind of attempts are going to look like. And, you know, what are we going to want to revise from the first attempts? You know, how are we going to want to, you know, analyze things, you know, the same way that I kind of, you know, found my way into the mix, you know, into this grassroots effort. You know, I think that, you know, open sourcing this initiative a little bit, you know, being very clear with people, you know, what are the frequencies that we're broadcasting on? What is it that we're broadcasting? Why are we broadcasting that? You know, and sort of inviting people if they have antennas themselves, if they want to try it on a small ham radio, if they want to do whatever, if they want to do it through a meditation or whatever, just, you know, opening this up so that, you know, when we do the next event and the event after that, these communication attempts, the amplification of the intention of what it is we're trying to do sort of, you know, assists in sort of getting this message out to whatever, whoever. I mean, it's, you know, there isn't, I mean, I don't think anyone in any of the conversations has there even ever been somebody kind of jumping to some kind of assumption of what or who we're hearing from. I mean, we're very much focused just on analyzing the frequencies. And I think, you know, that's something to be really to be commended. And it's why I felt very kind of moved to reach out to you guys and sort of finding myself in the mix with you all. And it's incredibly exciting. I think that, you know, with all of the chaos that's going on right now, you know, I would hope you know, that some type of communication would be, you know, established with the right intentions, you know, that this, you know, that this, you know, that knowledge, for example, as you were referring to the, you know, to theologians that, that NASA is looking for, you know, that this doesn't, this whole idea of humanity finding out that reality is much more strange than it already is, and our reality right now is much more strange than it was even a few
years ago. And extraordinary and encompassing, and it's not stopped by national boundaries. It's humans, it's us and whatever is around us. I mean, you are such an exemplification, Thomas, of, you know, one of those great movies, the one with the baseball thingy. If you build it, they will come, you know, because you showed up and you're the perfect, you know, I must say you have exactly the right background, and there's got to be more TJs out there. There's got to be more Thomases that will show up. At the right time. Yeah, thank you, Keith.
Well, I really want to thank, you know, the community that I'm a part of that sort of put this on the radar. I mean, that's the reason why I found myself there. So I really got to give it to everybody over at the Rabbit Hole, and specifically Soren. You know, this is a group on Telegram. I'm speaking to him or her right now, and they sort of made it public for people to join. But it's been somewhere where, you know, people are comfortable sort of talking about all sorts of really amazing stuff that's a little bit left of center. So I want to give those guys a thanks. And I'm looking forward to sort of getting into a little bit more of the details that we've been working on over the course of the last week and a half or so. Just for any of the listeners out there, you know, what we're in the process of doing right now is centralizing the sort of process of what we're going to be doing for the next transmission. I'll let Richard sort of dive into what that's going to look like. But if people go to the website and to the files under my name, I've got a PDF there, and it's basically some of the things that we're hoping to discuss a little bit this evening in terms of how we can refine a little bit of the approach. And I'll let Richard sort of kind of let the cat out of the bag, you know, in terms of what this next communication attempt is going to look like. But I mean, this is definitely a ramping up of things. And if there are people listening, it's going to be the next attempt is definitely if they're looking out for the right things. They're going to be impressed with what these little humans across the globe are in the process of pulling together. So,
well, based on the results we've had so far, I think we're talking their language. The problem is, I haven't a clue tonight who they are. And to give you an example, I'm a very mainstream kind of guy. I mean, Art talked me into doing this show, and it's been an adventure and kind of, you know, letting it hang out on the edge. But my background is networks, television, NASA, et cetera. And I was brought up in the mainstream on what's called the SETI paradigm. SETI being the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which is radio. You know, you get a big antenna, you send a signal, or you just, actually the paradigm is you don't stand, you just listen, because there's people who are kind of afraid of, you know, letting anybody else know out there that we exist. Well, that cat has long been out of the bag, and, you know, that train has left the station, because with the advent of radio, Tesla, Marconi forward, and with the advent of the DOD and huge, incredibly high-powered radars to track Russian missiles coming over the pole, you know, we have been broadcasting at all kinds of frequencies, including television, commercial television, AM, FM radio. We've been broadcasting our presence to the stars for literally over 100 years. So the presence of Earth and the presence of intelligent life on Earth, which can produce technology, is not a secret. We can no longer keep the Earth's presence a secret.
Well, I think if I could just sort of add to that, I mean, I think the difference being is that it's not just like a full spectrum of communications at this point. I mean, and again, sort of relating this back to a little bit of my background, when I began to see that these frequencies were related to holographic and you know, special types of primitive structures, right, in these ancient sites, but that you had similar symbolism in very radically different geographic areas. I mean, that was, it really got me super interested in this sort of aspect of things. So I think what's interesting about this now is that, and David and I had a really great conversation last night where we both sort of said, like, mass and these types of things are, it's sort of like the language of God to a certain extent. And like, I think sort of putting it out there that we are aware of these frequencies, we are aware of this physical structure or this hyperdimensional structure, or beginning to understand the hyperdimensional structure.
You said the magic word, yes. We're broadcasting, right? If the physics is right, if hyperdimensional physics is real science, we're finally broadcasting from this little speck of dust frequencies that say, hey, we know how reality works. And up until now, including all the SETI efforts or the military or the military-industrial complex or the Muse radars or all of that, nobody, as far as I know, has broadcast these specific frequencies and constants and fundamental geometries that our ancient ancestors physically encoded in, quote, so-called sacred sites all over the planet. Well, why are they sacred? Because they tap into the resonant frequencies of reality itself in the hyperdimensional model. To my background, I expected we would borrow Jimmy's antenna, we'd send a radio signal to Oumuamua, and 8 hours, give or take, later, we would get some kind of message back. Not within 2 minutes of him beginning the broadcast of our carefully prepared, you know, hyperdimensional package, which had constants and frequencies and lengths and musical tones and all that, and David can talk more to how it was encoded, suddenly UFOs started popping up, like, you know, photobombing the antenna in northern Arizona for the next 3 hours as we kept repeating the same transmission every few minutes. And we've got them on video, and Jimmy has zoomed in so you can see they're not points of light. They're structured geometric vehicles popping in and out of three-dimensional reality. And we got radio transmissions on the little handheld radios right away. Well, that right there kicks speed of light and standard Earth physics and mainstream science into a cocked hat, rolls it up, and stuffs it under the bed. Because we're obviously dealing with not one object in space, but a network of folks who are all able to listen and responded both in terms of these radios at these specific frequencies, as well as by visibly showing up over the antenna site and appearing right in the beam aimed toward Oumuamua, which was invisible in the dark 2.5 billion miles away, hours and hours before the signal could even get there. So we throw away mainstream physics, we look at the hyperdimensional model, and that brings me to John Womack. Because, John, you have been preparing some very elaborate, very interesting demonstrations on what your analysis of the first signals we got back and then subsequent signals actually might be trying to tell us, and you've got some very interesting comparisons between what we received and have recorded now in a couple of different forms compared to other signals in our environment that we as humans would be familiar with. So, John, you're on next.
Well, yes, we received the signals on December 4th, and David described them as chirps. And then we received additional signals on the 24th of December, and those are clicks. So, yeah. What creature makes clicks and whistles? And well, dolphins. So, like Star Trek IV, the message might not be meant just for humans. It might be directed at cetaceans as well. So I thought I'd do some comparisons. And in a perfect world, I would have...
Okay, we've got about 4 minutes to the bottom of the hour, but we'll pick this up on the other side. Okay, so continue.
Sure, yeah. In a perfect world, we would have somebody with us, say, from SETI, or that would have audio spectrum analysis software, which compared to the software I'm using, Adobe Audition, and a 3D visualizer, those are nice tools, but you realize when you look at the audio analysis software, you understand that Adobe Audition is geared toward vocals and music and this kind of thing, where the audio spectrum analysis, the software is directed, it's more for scientific study and analysis, and that's what they would have used, like in the movie Contact, when they deciphered the signal from ET. So that I don't have that software. It's not free, of course. It costs money, and I wouldn't know how to use it in the first place. So it would be nice if we got someone out there who has experience, and they work with this in their, you know, their day job, and they could analyze these signals we're getting, the chirps and the clicks. But it's not a perfect world. So, but in we have 2 minutes. I'd like to do a quick review, Richard. This is from my perspective, because sometimes you forget maybe my idea or my suggestion or my contribution. And when I think about what we're doing right now with Oumuamua, it takes me back 3 years to the month where I said, I'm an associate producer for your show. And I said to you, why don't we have David Sarita on? Because I really enjoyed, David, your video about the UFO tether incident, and it helps people understand that these aliens live in a higher dimension. They vibrate faster than we can see and so forth. So I said, let's have David Sarita on. And your email reply was, no ETs, no UFOs. I thought, oh, okay. And then a few months later, you asked me to fill in for you while you were on leave. And he said I could have anybody I wanted within reason. So I'm like, hey, David Sarita, what you doing? So, and since then, I think it's partly my influence, but I think Robin's passing also had a lot of influence on you as far as
opening
I'll tell
you
what,
hold it
to...
there. We're at the bottom of the hour. Okay. We'll pick this back right up where we are. My guest this morning, John Womack, who you just heard speaking. And yes, he was the guy who suggested David. David and I actually have known each other, years back. Our paths crossed, so it was not totally unknown. I'm not quite sure I was that strict on let's not do, you know, ETs. UFOs are, that's a whole other subject anyway. Be that as it may, you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. Don't touch that dial. Richard C. Hoagland here. I'd like you to support The Other Side of Midnight by subscribing to Club 19.5 and thereby joining our unique and growing radio community. Tune in to listen to our fascinating guests, pioneers on the out there edge of science and thought, and gain access to exclusive member benefits. To do this, just visit our website, theothersideofmidnight.com, and click on the Join Club 19.5 link in the navigator bar or in the left-hand column. Membership costs $19.95 per month. That's 33 tetrahedral cents a day. I mean, it's the price of a couple of cups of coffee. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to this show and literally hundreds of previous shows on hundreds of different topics going back to 2015 that we have done. Our archived shows have the commercials removed, and you'll be able to download the MP3 files directly from the 19-point archives if you prefer. To enhance your listener experience, a new The Other Side of Midnight podcast is being added to all show pages, which will allow you to instantly search the show archives of Radio with Pictures, thus easily accessing the corresponding show. Plus, you can just as quickly access the entire podcast list when you're on the go. I want to personally thank all our Club 19.5 members, because without your continuing support, this show would literally not be on the air. Please continue supporting the broadcast to provide you with the most interesting conversation available, talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. And if you like what you hear on The Other Side of Midnight, tell your friends and continue growing the show by having them subscribe to Club 19.5 as well, because we need all of you. And when I say we need you, you're the reason we're doing all this. Hoagland, over and out. Welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, January 8th, 2022, with the Webb Telescope almost at the L2 point, and in a few months, the most extraordinary revelations timed for what could be an extraordinary revelatory year will commence. Now, that's the upside. The downside, and I think all our panelists tonight would agree, given that the DOD has now established an official office of UFOs, I mean, they call it UAPs, but what's in a name, you know, Shakespeare, et cetera, they're UFOs, okay? And there's whoever's driving them, whoever's behind them, whatever civilization, whatever individuals. And I do not want the government to have a lock on, a monopoly on interpreted contact with whomever is out there. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I got behind the idea of doing some of this ourselves, never expecting we would get the incredible rich harvest of information that we have now gotten so far. And we frankly, given the number of hours we've recorded and the scale and the complexity and the nested chirps and, you know, digital bits and blips that we're getting, I would never have expected the richness of this tapestry. And as John said before the break, we need help to help us decode what it is we've gotten, certainly as a prelude to what we're going to try to do next. And in the next hour or so, we will talk in detail about the next plans in our, shall we say, ET communications effort. So in the meantime, John, back to what we have so far. What have you learned?
What have I learned? Well, let's go back to November again, because
Just as a reminder, and this is an overview of how we got here, you asked me to contact Avi Loeb because Oumuamua is in the news. Avi is on every talk show. You know, Good Morning America, I saw him. I saw him like on 10 different interviews. And so I wrote to him and didn't hear anything. You said, try him again. Wrote to him again, didn't hear anything. Like, he's got something against Richard or your show or something. And who else that is cool that would come on the show and is, you know, quote, famous and into UFOs and ETs and would be into this project with us? And I thought of Dan Aykroyd. And you said, do you know how to get in touch with him? And I'm like, gosh, no, there's no contact. But David Sarita is a friend of his. He probably has his. You said, oh, call David, see what he's doing. And so I sent David the email, and he's like, we're sending these radio signals, me and Jimmy. And then here we are. So I think it's very cool how this all came about. And sometimes getting snubbed by a celebrity like Avi Loeb is a good thing.
Well, back to that movie I talked about, you know, Field of Dreams, make no, you know, if you build it, they will come. I think the whole approach to Loeb is too early, that we don't know yet what we're doing. And Greg, my friend Greg Matloff, who was on the show, you know, several weeks ago, he's given me now a list of mainstream radio astronomers that we can go to. If we have a protocol, if we have a strategy, if we have a series of things and results from our first efforts that are tabulated, written up in a professional format, A, B, C, very metonymic, very left brain, so we can get them to start with listening on the right frequencies after we transmit. Because it seems to me that, David, we need to transmit to get answers, that's you know, it's like the old, Masonic thing. If you ask the right question, you will get an answer. We had to ask the question. We had to send our queries into the cosmos to get someone to respond. The second thing I want to make sure we cover is when we get to the phase two, we're going to be involving a lot of people, ordinary people, that all they'll need is to pick up one of these radios, and we will devote programs to teaching people how to participate all over the world, and we'll get into some of those details later on this morning. But what I want to go back, John, I want you to talk about comparing with your analysis some familiar terrestrial sounds, chirps, blips, squeaks, whistles, whatever, with what we've been getting from, all I'll say is, an extraterrestrial source, because again, this did not come back to us from Oumuamua at the limited speed of light. It came back instantly in the form of both radio transmissions on our dedicated frequency, or frequencies, because there are two of them, and also a bunch of ships showed up, which is kind of like blatant, guys, you got to get with the program. You know, we're not limited to speed of light. We're not limited to lack of control of gravity. You know, we're kind of what you're trying to say, and here's what is important as our response, and that in part has guided our development of this phase two that we'll talk about in detail in the next hour. So, John, back to you.
Yes, and it's interesting to me because I view this from two different perspectives. One is the perspective of the aliens who live in higher dimensions. You could also say it's Robin's perspective, because, you know, when you pass on, you pass on to higher dimensions. You don't die. You're still alive in the higher dimensions. And Robin sees everything we're doing and what we're thinking and so on. And also, here we are on a very 3D level using radio waves and waveforms to try and decode messages from ETs. And so it's an interesting dichotomy for me.
To make one kind of parenthetical statement, whoever's out there talking to us, they're not talking to us in the form of visions or dreams or projections in our consciousness, they're talking through radio. So at the moment, I'm kind of thinking that we don't really need the radio to transmit. I like Thomas' idea about intention, and I would like to use a focused intention cadre of people all over the world, synchronized in terms of time, kind of thinking the same, you know, message to see if we get responses on the radios to that. But the feedback loop, because we're such limited primitives, seems to be through these radios, and that's the way to democratize in three dimensions this communication with somebody.
Well put. Yeah, I agree. So what I did this past week, I didn't have much time because I was really busy. I got this crazy compulsion to set up a table in my living room and get a bunch of plaster and paint and build this thing.
Very funny.
But I did manage to get some time in the studio here. So first what I did is my item one, there's a link there to an online spectrum analyzer. So anybody can go there to this link and you can upload your sound and put it into this analyzer and see what it looks like. And they have sample sounds too that you can listen to. One of them is a human whistle. And what you see in this waveform in item one, the bottom is the, this is a Hertz waveform. So this is...
cycles per second.
Cycles per second. And you can see that the whistle in these bright yellow lines going across, that shows us that there is, when you whistle, we're hearing basically just one tone. There are some very light, there's a very light harmonic above the above the yellow. You see some
so
red
whistling
lines.
Is almost like a pure frequency. And can you actually play one? Can you play a sample?
You can if you go to the online spectrum analyzer and just click on whistle. They have, like I said, several sounds preloaded that you can listen to. And you can see that it's a pure tone. There's not much going on other than the tone of the whistle. By comparison, the item number two waveform, you can see that the violin frequency has many harmonics. It's creating, you know, you're playing a note on a violin and the string's vibrating.
Hang on. You're making me work here. This is terrible. My show, you're making me work. Okay. Here's the whistle, whose graphic spectrum analysis graphic is on the website as John's item number one. Here's the whistle. At least it's supposed to be. Okay. See, this is what happens when you don't rehearse. Ah.
Well, I could whistle if you want.
No. Oh, I see what I have to do here. Okay, you can see and hear that that's really almost one frequency, one very narrow band of tones, right?
Correct.
Okay, let's go to the violin. Okay, here's what that sounds like. And that's your number two graphic, right?
Correct.
Okay, what do we got else here? Okay, here's an orca. An orca is a whale, really. So let me go find the orca. Here we are. Here he comes. And that's your number three graph.
Yes, okay. And you can see with the orca song that there are also multiple harmonics in addition to what we hear. This graph shows us that there are multiple wavelengths generated by the whale's tone.
Right. Now, do we have the December 24th clicks? Because I don't have them ready. Do you?
Yes, it's one of my other items. I do have that listed here, so we can, if you want to listen to the December 24th clicks, it would be my item number.
I don't think I can play them from the website. I don't think they're playable.
It's number 7.
Oh, okay. It's, let me scroll down to 7. Let me go look.
I believe it's a YouTube video embed.
Okay, it's 7A. All right. Here's 20 seconds of the clicks. Now, these are my digital recording, right, of the December 24th response to the transmission that Jimmy sent at noon Mountain Time?
That's correct.
Okay, so here's what our digital response on Christmas Eve to our transmissions sounds like compared to what you just heard. Okay, now why am I not hearing it? Damn.
There is a few seconds before it starts.
Oh, there we are. I'm not hearing an appropriate. No. Something is filtering it. Can you play it from there?
I could.
Yeah. Yeah, let's do that. Okay. As I will fill the time at the tone of the time is, I can play Big Ben. Yes, yes. Okay. For some reason. Works. You found it? Oh, there we go. That's about 20 seconds in real time of what I sent you on the of an hour. I recorded an hour, mm-hmm. and then I, you know, took 15 minutes to figure out how to do the next hour, and then I did another hour. Then I waited for the speed of light to get the signal back, and then I did time straddling the Oumuamua speed of light time back to Earth. So we have a lot of data from the 24th, the 25th, the 26th, and David recorded it audio. And I recorded digital, and they don't sound the same. Why not?
Well, because it's language, and our language doesn't sound the same. When you look at my item number 4, it's the December 24th clicks. I just uploaded that to the online waveform analyzer just for fun to see what it would look like when I put it through theirs. Because this online analyzer is a lower resolution. It was developed by some students at a university, and hats off to them for doing that. But you can see in number 4 that as you go from the bottom to the top, these red columns are broken up. It's not one tone like you have with the whistle.
Mm.
It's more like the dolphin. There are higher harmonics. So, and these are just click sounds that they just sound like clicks to us. And just like in the movie Contact, that just sounded like, you know, it's just noise. It doesn't sound like communication. It doesn't sound like instructions to build a spaceship. No, it's just noise. So item number 5, I went to my library of sounds and picked out a dozen or so dolphin communications, and this one is clicks, chirps, and a whistle. And so far from a Oumuamua, we've received clicks and chirps, and maybe we'll get some whistles at some point. but you can see the waveform of those three distinct sounds. And in number...
Hang on. Describe what I'm looking at. I'm looking at green wavy lines up top. I'm looking at red and pink weird stuff on the bottom. And on the far right, I'm looking at what looks like a frequency sawtooth jagged curve.
Yes, the green chart is the amplitude. And on the bottom, you have the frequency.
So are these of the chirps, the clicks, or the whistle?
Well, the clicks are the first half, and then it goes to the chirps.
Ah, see that? You need to say that or write it down somewhere.
Okay.
Ah.
I feel like people would just know this
no,
by looking
they won't.
At it. But they
no,
don't.
No. Your average milkman like me does not know what I'm looking at. So think of me as a very dumb person to look at this stuff. You got to explain it so I get it. Thank you.
Yeah. For example, in the Hertz waveform, on the right side of that,
right.
These are the whistles. I find that very interesting because you can see that there are many harmonics.
Is that the human whistle we heard before?
No, a dolphin whistle.
Oh, a dolphin. Okay, well, got to talk about that. Okay. Now, if I play 5A, will we hear these?
Oh, you can click on that.
It says noise.wave. All right, so this is a wave file. So why am I not hearing? Okay, that's why I'm not. Start it again. Now the clicks are Oumuamua.
The clicks are the dolphin clicks.
Oh, see that? I didn't know. That's why I have to ask. So this is all dolphin language.
Yes.
Huh. Now
there's an unknown element to this. I don't know if the dolphin clicks were recorded underwater. I would say the chirps were recorded above water.
Right.
The whistles could have been underwater as well. And
okay, here's the time to insert some news. You know how the networks all have breaking news. Okay, other side of midnight, breaking news. I have been in contact with someone who actually works with dolphins, who is going to be very receptive to getting our signals, gentlemen, and playing them for the dolphins under their care, and will video the response.
Nice.
Okay, now that's a work in progress. All I can say is that line of communication has been opened, and we'll report probably next week where we are with it. But this does almost sound like cetaceans talking, very much like some of the clicks that I recorded. Very curious.
Absolutely.
I have a vaguely relevant thought here.
Okay, you're way over my...
Am I on? Me?
Yes, you.
Okay.
You.
Is that better? Yeah, it's better balance.
You're on the wrong pot for me, so I have to turn it down. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I will speak softly. Now, all I know is this: all this stuff with the clicks and the whistles and the harmonics. I wanted to say this, but this seemed like the moment. A long, long time ago, for all of you out there that are under 50, you probably won't remember bookstores. But there used to be this metaphysical bookstore that I hung out at, and they played weird foreign music over there.
You mean
their,
like
Poetry? It was called the Unicorn. It was in La Jolla, but it's
oh, okay.
And they put. I walked in one day, and they were or one evening, and they were playing music from the Andes. You've all heard this. I mean, Art got fascinated with the Andean music, and then he started playing whatever that commercial band's name is all the time. But this was the real thing, played on those panpipe, like flutes, you know, where they each note has a separate tube and you move your mouth around and go,
right.
Yeah. And I listened to it for like 5 minutes and I wasn't thinking of such things. And I went, well, that's the music of Atlantis. It has to be. It has to be. There was something so pure and fundamental about something that was built just on those tones that way.
And just ethereal.
And it wasn't the ethereal part. It's just the way that it sounds and it's balanced. If everybody has heard it, even though they don't know that, because that was Paul Simon got fascinated with that kind of music himself, and he hooked up with a band that called themselves Urubamba, which is the sacred river that runs through Ecuador. And everybody's heard the songs off of his albums that had him backing. You know, like da 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 da. Well, never mind. You don't want to listen to me hum or anything. But yeah, people are going yes, yes, those guys. But anyway, they do have an album that he produced for them that came out after that, but which should be easy to find. But the there's plenty of music from the absolutely ethnic bands like the Calchaquis and the Chacos. If you just look it up, they came out of French record labels, and you can download tons of it, as much as you want. And there's something hypnotic and just magic about it.
Yeah, except we're not hearing pure tones. We're hearing complex multi-waveforms that sound to our ear like chirps and clicks until you spread them out and slow them down and, you know, really get into the guts of the frequencies.
Well, that's the time frame. You know, it's just the you slow them down, you can put them into what we can hear. But I have no doubt that other sea creatures, some at least, have some capability of recognizing and hearing them, you know, because that's part of their usual environment. They don't hear CNN blaring in the background. They hear the dolphins and the whales communicating.
We're basically coming up to the top of the hour, so everybody hold it there. I will do this. Okay. And I will do this. This conversation is going to expand radically in the next hour or so as we talk about what we're going to do next, based on what we have found so far and the ongoing analysis to find more. My guests this morning are Ron Gerbron, who was just talking, and John Womack, who has done a splendid job of analyzing in various ways and comparing what we've got so far. David Sarita, our numbers man, our go-to numbers guy. And, of course, Tom Mathers, who is a new member of the team, with some very interesting ideas, which we will get to in the next hour. You're on the other side of midnight. We're talking about ET communication with someone out there. And when I say out there, we may not be dealing simply with outer space. We may be dealing with higher dimensions, including people who are no longer here. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio with pictures on demand. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to The Other Side of Midnight for this Saturday night, now Sunday morning. Saturday, January 8th, grading into Sunday, January 9th. My God, 9 days into the new year already. And we've just unfolded the Webb Space Telescope. Oh, my God, is that going to give us something to really crow about? Wait till you see. Tonight we're talking with our team, part of it anyway, about communicating with whoever is out there, whoever answered the phone. Because frankly, there's no way to know whether it was, you know, photo guys on Oumuamua or an AI or a robot or the facsimile of a Bracewell probe, because it doesn't follow the ordinary SETI rules. It's definitely faster than light. It seems to be preoccupied with what you're thinking. And every time I try to think about recording what's coming in, the damn radio just shuts off. I mean, I've never, ever listened to a DJ who did not want me to record what they were doing. They don't know what I'm doing. Whoever is on the other side of this technology knows what I am doing. Thinking. I mean, let me repeat that again. Whoever is on the other side of this technology, whether I put the radio in the pyramid or I put it on the coffee table or I put it on the little table next to the couch, it knows what I am thinking. And as soon as I think I'm going to record this or try, it completely shuts down and will sit there with the wires connecting it to the computer, absolutely silent. I take the cable out. It starts chattering away. That is not normal, which means we cannot approach this as a normal scientific project. Yes, we can provide scientific protocols, but we must create out-of-the-box thinking for confirming and duplicating and democratizing the signals are getting. My guests again, David Sarita, Tom Mathers, and John Womack. John, let's quickly go through some of the rest of your stuff, then I want to open it up to discussing what do we plan to do next.
Okay. Well, number 5B is another waveform of a dolphin chirp, because what I wanted to do is compare the dolphin chirps to the Oumuamua chirps and the clicks to the clicks. So 5B is dolphin chirping. You know, just like, what was that show back in the 60s, Richard?
Flipper!
Oh, my gosh. And so you can see on 5B that the chirp, the green part is the amplitude. It's a very, you know, it's a distinct waveform. And you can see in 5D that the December 4th chirps, indeed, the amplitude waveform matches, it resembles.
It's pretty damn close.
It's pretty damn close. And same with the frequency, the Hertz waveform. And if we go down
now, that,
to five...
Now, that is not to say that the other end of the phone, there are dolphins. Okay, let me be very clear. Okay?
Yeah.
But dolphins normally are recorded underwater by researchers. And the speed of sound is much higher underwater than it is in air. So if you record a chirp from a dolphin underwater, it'll sound highly compressed. What we're getting from the radios sounded to me, first time I heard it, highly compressed. That's why I said, let's try to slow it down. That's an analog. It doesn't mean there are dolphins at the other end of the phone or the radio. It simply, to me, says that the frequencies that are being sent to us are accelerated in our time frame, like recording dolphin chirps underwater.
Exactly. And moving along, number six is an image of a dolphin click, and just zoomed in. The top green part is the amplitude waveform, and the bottom is the hertz. And the graph on the right is simply a sawtooth, as you called it, Richard. It's just a zoomed frame of where the playhead is at that point.
Ah, I see. Okay. The vertical red line.
Yeah.
Okay.
The on the right is the amplitude.
Yeah. It's zoomed in on the amplitude there. So we have the dolphin click there. And then on 6A, we have the December 24th click. That's an amplitude waveform as well. And you can see
that. This is the Oumuamua response.
Oumuamua response.
And we're using Oumuamua in a generic sense because, frankly, I could not prove tonight, if someone were to stand me up against a wall with a blindfold, I could not prove that we're getting signals from Oumuamua. I think it's much more general. I think it's the whole damn neighborhood. It's like a party line, or in technical parlance, back in the 1930s, a brilliant physicist named Paul Dirac proposed something called a Dirac transmitter receiver, which could receive frequencies from all over the universe in excess of the speed of light at the subquantum mechanical levels. And I think that's the party line that we've tapped into, and the folks who are responding are kind of using that frequency when we send a query. Very interesting coding and deciding who the intended audience is. Anyway, continue, please.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, Richard. Now, if we get on to earlier, we played the clicks from December 24th. It's a 22nd sample of clicks. That's from a one-hour recording that you did around noon on December 24th.
Mm-hmm.
So what I thought I would do next is, like you said, Richard, slow it down and just start digging in and playing. So I used a filter. It's called time and pitch, and you can use it to slow down the playback and the pitch at the same time. And the image of that waveform, after I applied that to this 20-second sample, you can see how the waveform is changed. It's stretched.
Are we talking 7B?
7B.
Okay.
That highlighted area is the slowed down clicks on December 24th. So you can see that this looks like language. This looks like somebody's singing, or they're playing an instrument, or they're having conversation, or something to that effect. This isn't just random clicks. So you can listen to that.
Okay, I can probably try to play it, but I bet it's not going to work here because we're having a technical problem. Let me try. Yeah, see, it's barely registering. Can you play it?
Yeah, I can play it here.
Okay.
And fire this baby up. Yeah, that's very interesting sound.
Now,
if I can interject just for 2 seconds, the first half of those samples actually sound like they've been reversed. When it goes to the faster click towards the end of the isolated time period that you just played,
it sort of goes back to normal, but the extended ones, definitely it would be interesting to sort of isolate that other part and try reversing it and see how those the clicks register.
So you want to do the I buried Paul bit with it.
Well, actually, it's like John David Oates, because way back when Art and I were working with John, you know, I got really into the whole reverse speech thing, and I spent like a whole weekend at John's place listening to a lot of recordings. And I said to him at that time, and I'm going to bring this up again, Tom, because I think it's a brilliant insight. What if John David Oates' backwards speech was really from another dimension, and the time rates between us and that are flowing so differently that we're literally hearing things backwards? And I think the same idea applies to this. What if we're hearing the frequencies backward because of the time differential between where it's coming from, another dimension, and where we're receiving it, which is here?
Well, the interesting thing about what he just played is that not all of the samples sound like they're reversed. So I'm very familiar with stretching out samples and speeding things up and slowing them down and reversing them. I do a lot of sound design, and you know, these are certain sort of manipulations.
You realize
that
you've just done, right? You've laid out a protocol for your own work on this. You've raised your hand and volunteered.
But no, you want to use this sound. You got to, because this is pure digital versus going through the speaker. And the speaker has a little more warmth. I know chirps aren't warm sounding.
But we need to do both. We obviously need to do both.
Okay? We also talked about time dilation. And I like to do some of the slowdowns that vary.
Well, wait. Let us get to the end of John's thing here, because he's done hell of a lot of work. And then I want everybody to respond, particularly Tom. But I want him to get through what he's done, because he's done a hell of a good job here.
Oh, thanks, Richard.
You're welcome.
Now, the one we just...
I just want to say you've done a hell of a good job. I've been listening.
You've done a good job of working with these. It's actually quite useful to be able to see the visual representations of what you've done with the audio.
Oh, cool. Thanks, Thomas. Now, what we just listened to, that was slowed down 50%. Then I went in 7D, I slowed it down 200%, and I added some eight semitones, which are half notes, like A to A sharp would be a semitone.
Now we're kind of talking Close Encounters language.
Yeah, so do you want me to...
Yes.
Wait a second, let me just make a quick point here. See, with a pure digital signal, let's say I give you 35 hertz, pure digital. And I ring an aluminum bar, an iron bar, and a gold bar. They're all going to sound different because the feedback through the different materials will have a different level of warmth or coldness. And so therefore, I think the digital signal you're hearing is pure digital. Whereas when you run a digital signal through a speaker, it also depends on what the magnet's made out of.
Well, you get overtones and harmonics and, you know.
Yeah, it's totally different because in music, it's the same. Like horsehair in a violin is going to sound different than plastic strings, right? And so the quality of materials in response to frequencies is very unique, even though you can have the same frequency.
But is that part of the intended message, or is that basically Barry McLuhan-esque in that
I'm pulling out numbers with a frequency meter that are two decimals accurate.
That's true.
Now, have you heard of...
We need to do the same thing with the digital. We need to see if you get frequencies with the digital, and maybe they're an overlay or a harmonic or a subtext or, you know, another channel.
Oh, yeah, you're right, but also there's something called earth whistlers. They're space sounds.
Yes.
And one thing that's interesting about earth whistlers, and I put a link to them on the chat there, is they're continuous. And again, these chirps are not continuous. And
no.
They your radio will go quiet all day, like mine's been quiet all day at the frequency I have it.
Mine's
on,
chattering
anyway.
Away like a damn monkey until I want to record it. Then it goes totally silent. Totally.
Right. So that means person. We've talked about this before. We're seeing personality.
Consciousness does not want to be recorded. It's like, okay, you can record your own stuff, but leave our stuff alone. Our stuff is private. Our stuff is prioritized. Our stuff is what's that word I'm looking for? Privileged.
Classified.
In other words, it's not democratic. It's like we're tuning in on a party line, and they say, okay, you can listen, but if you want to record it, no way. And they cut it right off, which is insane. It's not the way radio is supposed to work.
No, because we're not dealing with radio. Remember, a radio is just an interface. I mean, if we didn't have music to play on the radio and we only could listen to the news, I don't think it would be very popular.
I don't either. Okay,
well, what's
so
interesting is it kind of...
Let's let
yeah,
John
just
finish.
Yeah, that it's sort of... Okay,
and then we'll have, you know...
Like, we're a really excited bunch of chipmunks here who want to respond to Jonathan.
Well, no, it's just going along with what you guys just said, is it's sort of like the double slit experiment, where if you don't have somebody that's actually observing, that it actually affects the outcome of the experiment. So... Like
that's interesting that you're saying that, because a female body will respond to a sound vibration different than a male, and a fat person will sound different than a skinny person. Their response to what they're hearing will sound different, actually.
So anyways, I just want to interject there, Richard.
Everybody wants to say one more thing. John, come on.
All right, 70, I'm just going to go ahead and play it here so you can hear. This is slowed down 200%.
These are clicks now, my digital clicks.
Yes.
Okay.
This 20-second sample.
Recorded on December 21st, probably right around noon when Jimmy started the transmission.
Yep.
24th, not 21st, 24th. Oh my God.
Is that crazy?
There's information nested.
No, that's sounding like the contact signal.
Right. It ends with a final sharp, and that's how when you talk, like I say the word talk, the T is sharp and tuck, the K is, you know, a little sharp, but, you know, it has a little resonance at the end of it.
Yeah, John, let me ask a very, very dangerous question on real-time live radio all over the world. Can you easily reverse that now live for us?
No, I'd have to do it during the break.
Okay, all right. We have it like an hour and 20-some minutes or whatever. We might try to, because I really am now intrigued as hell as to what this sounds like. If these are reversed, what do they sound like forward?
Well, remember, the Arabs read right to left, we read left to right. So
yeah, but time reversal is not something people do. They can't do.
No.
All right? So this is not like Arabic script. This is tonal. This is time. This is maybe someone's deliberately reversing it to teach us about time differential.
Wait a second. Yeah. We need to run this underwater, and there's a reason for it. See, there's a reason sound travels faster underwater, and that's because...
Well, the density of water.
Well, it's not only the density, it's the interconnectedness of the fibers, and that's what I'm seeing with these squares and cubes as a matrix of what we're dialing into. You know, I don't think if you understand the idea of action at a distance... Einstein's action at a distance, and Dirac's sea of negativity, which there's no resistance to movement. Everything's instantaneous. So it's possible that these radios, whoever made them, and the reason why the FCC banned the sale of them, and because they're doing the same thing that Tesla and Marconi, you know, were tuned into, we could be tapping in with specific frequencies to a cubic matrix, like millions and millions and millions of infinitely fine, it's like a web. It's literally like a universal wide web. And if you have a universal wide web and you pluck a string in the interconnected web, it's faster than light.
Well, it's the original World Wide Web, except it's a universe wide web.
It's a universe-wide hyper. Wave, that's what I'm saying. But it doesn't rely on the speed of light at all.
No, it's the torsion field, i.e. the ether. Okay, I think that everybody wants to talk, so we've got about 10 minutes to the bottom of the hour. What do you hear, Thomas, that kind of, you know, gets your blood racing in terms of things you now think of that you might do to help us understand this better?
Well, I think, the important, when I was mentioning about the reverse, it's very much just, you know, if you recognize what a reverse sounds like, you know, when that has been slowed down, some of those seem reverse. You know, the initial, quality of the signal that I think got me very interested was really about the rhythm and the cadence of the chirps. When you work with audio for a long time,
you mean like as a series of code?
What? Not so much a code. It's just more of like the flow. So it's
when you listen to a really good operator doing Morse, there's a music to it. It's not the dots and dashes. It's the rhythm of the operator. Exactly. Bobby. What's his name?
They call it his hand.
Well, what I'm getting at is that you become familiar with what is going to be kind of like a digital artifact, okay? Something that like a digital circuitry would do. It becomes glaringly obvious to somebody who's been listening to a lot of sound to differentiate a sound source from an analog source versus a digital source. But what really got me curious about this before, you know, processing this and slowing it down, which is important because, you know, again, the chirps are such a fast sort of signal. There are algorithms that are time stretching this, so you have to take some of that into consideration. But the thing that still is very interesting to me is that the general feeling of the cadence, the rhythm, the flow of this does not feel mechanical. So it does not feel like a mechanical source. There feels, and that was the first thing that I like that the first time that I heard you guys playing this at the full speeds. It was the first thing that I noticed. It almost had the cadence of somebody talking, you know.
Well, that was David's impression. He said
exactly.
His language.
And it's interesting that he has the same impression because that implies, like, you know, when you're listening to a couple of, you know, women talking or chattering with each other, it's like birds talking, right? Like, you know, it has a rhythm to it. I know what Thomas is saying.
The chauvinism.
Like they're sitting there smoking their cigarettes
the
and going, like, complaining about men.
The chauvinism.
Humanity complaining about men. And they're just sitting there and they have this vibe to them. He's right. There's no repeatable, reliable, you cannot mathematically quantify. Even if I measure the spacing between the chirps, they're all out of phase with each other, which is how people talk.
Yeah.
Some people talk very predictably. Like some people are very monotone sounding, you know, when they're talking, like especially a scientist would be. If you don't have a lot of personality, you know, when you're talking.
From the rhythm, you can interpret emotion. I mean, you could just take a singular note or a singular sound and sort of catch the rhythm of a conversation. And, you know, when people are stressed out, they speak more quickly and there's certain things. So it is kind of a feeling. You know, what I think is kind of interesting is, and this kind of goes back to, again, what you were mentioning, Richard, in terms of wanting to compare the digital source versus an analog sampling from the radios. Now, you know, as we discussed this past week, obviously you've got technical limitations in terms of what the radios are able to produce through their speakers. Their speakers are going to have a technical specification in terms of what their frequency range is going to be. That being said, you know, I think what's interesting here is that the intention, the frequencies, the math, connecting back to this, again, this what David was alluding to in terms of this sort of, you know, this cubic, and I could sort of expand on that into sort of a hyper-dimensional matrix, right? This would allow some type of like a hyper-dimensional tunneling or quantum tunneling, which would explain how some of these signals are being received much more quickly than coming back at the speed of sound. But
exactly.
now that we've really been able to take a look at some of these slowed down and sort of going through it together, it is very interesting how they're behaving. Okay. Because this is, I believe, John, this was pulled from Richard's digital recording, right? This was not pulled from the from David's analog recording, correct?
It was pulled from Richard. Well, Richard sent me an MP3, and I converted it to a wave.
But
Richard's is digital, and mine is sound, and there is a big difference.
Exactly. So this is what's interesting is that when you have slowed it down, which is sort of giving you a little bit more time to analyze each individual chirp, the picture of each individual ones, you know, are very different. So, I mean, it really does warrant some further investigation to really be taking each individual chirp and time stretching, running different sort of things through it. I think that in this next week, that would be something that that I could help out with as well.
Fantastic.
Wouldn't it be neat to run it underwater and see what it sounds like underwater?
Yeah. The thing with that is that you're sort of then you're reproducing the sound through like a speaker. So
you're adding a level of noise to me. You know, it might be interesting qualitatively, but to me, it's what we're getting is pure, and to me, the best purity is the digital, and the other, the overtones, the numbers.
Yes, and
go ahead.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, I think on the surface you could say that, but there comes some other sort of interesting effects that happen when you're talking about sampling a analog source. That's why I think as we move forward with this, it's very important that we sample both.
Which is the perfect segue to what I want to talk about in the next hour, which is what the hell are we going to do next? And we've got some really exciting things planned, and you're going to be part of them. So we'll kick that off in this way. Do not touch that dial.
In your mind, you have capacities, you know, to telepath messages through the vast unknown. Please close your eyes and concentrate with every thought you think upon the recitation we're about to say. Calling occupants of interplanetary craft. Calling occupants of interplanetary most extraordinary craft. Calling occupants of interplanetary craft. Calling occupants of interplanetary craft. Calling occupants of interplanetary most. We are your friends.
Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, now Sunday morning. Karen Carpenter, a song which I think is going to become very, very famous, even more famous than it was back in the 1970s, in the not-too-distant future, because if we can quantify and kind of systematize what we're getting, and if we can decode beyond the numbers that David has been able to pull out of this data stream, extraordinary numbers, numbers which led us to, among other places, ancient terrestrial monuments on Earth. It actually may be much more than "we are your friends." It may be "we are your cousins." You know, what's interesting about this song is that she talks about "with your minds." One of the things we're going to do, and we're going to talk about this momentarily in phase two and phase three, we're going to try to do this without radio at all. Maybe the radio is a feedback mechanism, recording, video, sound, audio. But we may be actually trying to send messages by intention. Isn't that an interesting idea? For hyperdimensional beings at the other end of an interstellar phone. What an age we're living in, 2022. And you know, the most amazing part of this is that we're doing it for real. We've got real messages. We've got real data. We've got real waveforms. We've got real information. We've got real contact with someone or something. And all we need is to find out who. Okay, the time has come to talk of cabbages and kings and sealing wax and many things. And one of those things is, what do we plan to do next? So let me invite the panel back in. And let me give a little setup, okay? All of us, John, myself, David, Thomas, I mean, everyone who's kind of gotten roped into this fascinating vortex have thought, because we're getting feedback in terms of ancient sacred sites, it kind of became a consensus, particularly after we got the first transmissions back from the moon, which basically said, Stonehenge, Stonehenge, look at Stonehenge. And then we got Maria involved, and Maria, of course, has been working with John and leaped off at Warp 9 and now has two radios. And what we're going to do, and we're going to do it on the 4th of February at dawn in Great Britain. Well, actually about 8 a.m. because English Heritage wouldn't let her and her team in any earlier. We're going to have Maria in the center of Stonehenge transmitting, probably by a recording piped into the mic of the radio, or maybe an audio trigger where it's playing and then she just, you know, keys the mic. We're going to transmit the same information with maybe some modifications that we sent out to Oumua over the last several weeks. And then we're going to have other participants at other sacred sites around the world with these handheld radios receiving and recording responses on what I would think of as the, not the old boy network, but the old ancient boy network. And we're going to compare the responses, overlay them in time, and see if we get the same responses to each recipient in their own sacred site, sacred space. And remember, science is nothing if it's not prediction. So I'm thinking that what we might get would be very tailored responses depending upon which person is in which sacred site and why that site is significant to the ancient history of the human race and who we really are. What I asked Tom to do, since he seems to be most organized of all of us, is to lay out a protocol for doing this literally on paper. And although it's not technically on paper, it is actually on the other side of midnight. And what you want to do is go to the other side of midnight, click on tonight's banner, which is a Oumuamua or someone answers. Click on that. That will take you to the guest page. Click on Thomas for fast links. That will take you down to his document, a PDF document I want everyone to open and then download. And Tom, you are now going to tell us what it is you envision for phase two.
Okay, thank you. So, you know, I think the most important part of all of this, and this was one of the first things that you and I discussed, Richard, and what's going to be amazing about this whole process is that we are going to be able to, in a very transparent way, demonstrate different chains of custody and be able to sort of establish different protocols in terms of how we're capturing some of these signals. And I think in our conversations, we sort of realized that if we are to garner more attention and get more people, specifically people that may not think outside of the box too often, you know, I'm sort of pointing my fingers more towards academia. You know, one of the best ways for us to be able to pique people's curiosity and get their attention is, again, to, I think, be able to apply a little bit of the sort of science method, the scientific method, for us to be doing this. So as this is coming together, and with David's amazing analysis of the numbers, which I think is, if there is going to be any kind of data or information that's going to be transmitted, especially in a very short sort of like chirp, I think that what David's found and what he's seen in these responses is incredibly important, and it has kind of unraveled and sort of leading us all deeper down this path. So for people that are, oh, sorry, my cat just knocked over a lamp.
Wants to be part of the conversation, obviously.
he does, apparently. So one of the first things that David and I talked about was taking a look at, one, potentially looking at broadcasting outwards on, and I'll let David sort of dive in here. If it's okay, I'd like to just kind of bounce this back and forth because, you know, there's things that I think he can much more eloquently go into and explain. But, you know, the outward frequency, we had some ideas in terms of you know, what frequency we can be transmitting out of. And then the original signal, which, again, I think is something that we should include as part of, subsequent transmissions, and then build upon this. I think one of the, I would believe that one of the reasons why we're getting some type of response, or there's this, these beginning building blocks to some type of communication, is really because of the awareness and us sort of incorporating different elements that relate back to some of these sacred frequencies, the sacred geometries, the sacred sites. So, you know, for the next broadcast...
In other words, the hyperdimensional physics.
Precisely. I mean, what we want to be doing is trying to tickle that sort of hyperdimensional matrix and allow for us to be able to receive with our very primitive technologies signals that could be coming through some type of a hyperdimensional tunneling. Are they responding to the intention? Are they responding to the radio frequencies? Are they responding to both?
We actually have some data because,
yes,
according to Blanchett, nothing happened on his low light level TV camera. And we've been intending this for like days and days. Nothing happened on, you know, the David's radio or Jimmy's radios or whatever until Jimmy started transmitting about half hour before airtime on the evening of Saturday the 4th. And 2 minutes later, you can look at the videotape, which is, I think it's my fourth item up there. Bingo, they showed up. And they didn't show up as objects, flying saucers, gently moving across the sky and wobbling in the falling leaf formation and all those classical thingies. They literally popped into space, into 3D space, allowed themselves to be imaged on the camera, then disappeared. And then a few minutes later, another one or two would pop in. And this went on for 3 hours. So the way they appeared and disappeared, they did not transverse 3D space. They literally came from some other space, hyperspace, a hyperdimension, entered our dimension like a lesson, like this is how we roll, okay? And then they went away.
I think the transmission through the antenna, it could have been sort of like a flare. Like, hey, look into this. Be aware of this.
Well, it was like, okay, these guys are serious. They're really doing it.
The intention part, if we were all master, you know, master meditators and just that, you know, like in a complete Zen sort of space and completely, you know, getting our consciousness to cross different sort of like hyperdimensional realms. Like if we were a team of people like that, you know, maybe setting the intention out would be a little bit more effective. But, you know, I think it's
well, we're going to try that. We're going to put people down the road in sacred spaces and just have them think at a certain time.
Absolutely. So what I'd like David to sort of talk about is, like, so one, I mean, the original frequency that we're broadcasting out of, If you could sort of talk a little bit about the conversation where we were potentially looking at maybe for this subsequent transmission that we do it on a second frequency as well. I had also, you know, told this to you and mentioned this to David as well, that it could be interesting in terms of, you know, instead of thinking that we need the most powerful and the biggest antenna to be doing this, perhaps there's something that, again, we can be incorporating through sacred geometry measurements, some type of a physical antenna structure that could be used as an additional sort of way to amplify the signal. The whole idea of going to these ancient sites is fantastic, because most of these ancient sites, and in my personal experience going to places, and I think this is a universal thing for anybody that's had the opportunity to visit a sacred site around the world, is that they do feel like natural frequency amplifiers, whether it be an actual physical frequency being generated from a radio or an antenna, or whether it be
well,
a frequency.
Robin and I went around, and I actually was able to measure these places with the Accutron, which is basically an inertial measurement detector. It measures the change in inertia of a vibrating tuning fork and then puts it into computer code so you can see it as a graph. I got astonishing readings at Stonehenge. They gave us, when we did the moon bounce on the 18th or 11th, I forget, was it the 11th, David, or the 18th?
I'm not sure the exact date anymore.
I think it was the 18th. We got the 56th, which is the Aubrey holes, which is the base of the blue stones, as Maria told us, that was Stonehenge 1.
She said it was Stonehenge 1.
Yeah, but those holes had the stones in them, 56, and that's important in the physics. So they told us Stonehenge. So what I would recommend...
Yeah, that's why I need to know the exact diameter, inner diameter of that circle
to determine. I have all that. I was going to send it to you.
Okay.
What
I'm
going to recommend...
extruding all these
what
I'm Stonehenge
recommend,
models, too.
What I'm going to recommend is that we have Maria come on next Saturday, and we plan out in detail in front of the world, make it transparent, how people all over the world can participate by being listeners and recorders in the network. Because what I'm thinking is going to happen, and I will recommend strongly based on the numbers, that we have Maria transmit on 432, not 144.1 or any other.
I don't think it's either. That's why I want to determine the frequency even of the megalithic yard itself. Because if Stonehenge was made, again, you determine the frequency.
Yeah,
of the
but we transmitted to the moon at 432 and 144.1, right?
Yeah, but now remember, because they sent me. First of all, remember we sent them to Oumuamua. The musical tones, which are 432 octaves of the Washington Monument, and they sent back the Washington Monument measurement with a tiny correction, and that's miraculous. But because they sent me the perfect royal cubit twice, they sent me the square of the royal cubit and the square of two royal cubits. Perfect. So I decided to calculate the frequency of an antenna at one perfect royal cubit of 20.601 inches, and it comes to 143.231 megahertz. Again, that's 432 is right in the middle of that number. And that is mind-blowing, the fact that a perfect royal cubit produces 143.231. I mean, that's mind-blowing. So I turned my radio on this week to that frequency without doing a single transmission, and it was dead quiet, but I was having an afternoon nap. After shoveling snow.
A lot of
being
snow.
Wiped out. And a lot of snow. And all of a sudden the radio went crazy. And I recorded the responses on the radio and the frequencies. And the frequencies were longitude, latitudes. And again, we know where the location is. And it also is possible that there are multiple locations and a date that begins with 2020-something. It looks like I'm seeing a number called 2020-something, and I'm not ready to give out the... So what if there is a... Well, there is a latitude and longitude, but what if there's a date for something that will happen on that latitude, longitude? Well, it looks like there is. And so, again, another sacred site.
This is sounding so much like Close Encounters and the Rendezvous at Devil's Tower.
Well, watch this. Chaco Canyon in New Mexico, just south of you, Richard.
No, it's northwest of me.
Northwest of you. Okay, so I took my kids there and my wife 3 years ago.
Yeah, and I took
them. And I went in with a – this is my item two tonight in my items. Item one was the frequency 143231, 143.231 megahertz. And item two is Chaco Canyon. And what's mind-blowing about the primary circle complex in Chaco Canyon, I found a perfect Solomon's Temple, Holy of Holies, using the Hebrew long cubit perfectly, 34.05 feet. And if you use the right royal cubit for the Hebrews as their long cubit, which is 20.43 inches, you get 43.05 feet. Now, I was so excited that day. I went to the park rangers and I said, you guys know you have a Holy of Holies in there? I said, perfect, on a like a laser. So that means I can deter. I think we need somebody in Chaco Canyon with a laser, but it's not going to happen in February if you got snow there because you can't get in that place. Because it's a very, very long road.
I know. We've driven it. Yeah, Robin and I took her son, Michael, and we sang. And the harmonics of Chaco Canyon are astonishing. And now, of course, I don't think they're accidental.
No, they're not, because they're using the same measurements that Solomon's Temple used. Exactly. I mean, to a T, this is phenomenal.
Okay, let's get back to Stonehenge, because... 4:30.
Okay, Stonehenge.
Hang on. 4:32 is part of the moon. The moon is 1080 miles in diameter, 2160 in radius, 2160 in diameter. They gave us Stonehenge. We didn't send anything about Stonehenge to the moon in the transmission, but they gave us Stonehenge back. So if we start with Stonehenge as the anchor of this network, I think we ought to talk the language of the moon Stonehenge connection, which is 4:32. Now we can try some other things, and we can record.
I think, Richard, what we should do is I think that we should sort of keep things consistent from the first transmission.
Exactly.
Make sure that we're also tapping into the 4:32.
Control your variables. Don't vary
exactly.
Everything.
And then dive deeper into what the next frequency that David is identifying. Again, going back to what I was sort of and again, for anybody listening out there, if you go on to the items, this is a part of the PDF. You can go and look through this. These are sort of the considerations and things that we wanted to go through and be able to discuss. But if in the next transmission we start really ramping things up and start including, and this is based off of some conversations I had with David. And again, I mean, the parallels with Close Encounters of the Third Kind are just, it's a little bit ridiculous. But again, the fact is...
Well, wait. Why is it ridiculous? Hang on. Why is it ridiculous? Maybe Spielberg is one of the in crowd. And remember, Hollywood presents films that are coded for the in crowd, a la my friend Gene Roddenberry. But Dick, if it's real, it'll be on television. If Close Encounters was basically a tableau for the in crowd, the only will believe it if they see it in media, then if he's an inner guy, if he's part of the inner circle, then everything in Close Encounters should be paid very close attention to, because it's a primer for what to really do.
I just think it's important that people just don't think that we're using this as sort of like a step-by-step instructional video, right? Like, you know, but anyways, I mean, in all seriousness.
Well, do you want to hear something really mind-blowing about Close Encounters? And okay. I wanted to try to find it, and I couldn't find it in time for tonight, but I will by next week. When they came to the sequence, remember where they stole the globe from the superintendent's office to find the latitude, longitude of where the ship was going to come down and they would meet. Remember that scene?
And then
they gave the latitude and longitude. The latitude and longitude in the movie is totally wrong for Devil's Tower. Totally wrong. Big, huge error except it's not. You know what the latitude and longitude of the actual movie scene in Close Encounters refers to? The latitude and longitude of the face on Mars from NASA. And there are so many other coded Mars references in that film. It's not funny, starting with the first scene, remember, Ares Airlines? There's no Ares Airlines. Ares is Mars. So Close Encounters, which I decoded decades ago, is an ode to what's on Mars. And the latitude, longitude of the famous globe scene for Devil's Tower has nothing to do with Devil's Tower. It has to do with the lat long of Cydonia and the face on Mars.
Wow.
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 Wow. That is a wow.
No, that is a big wow.
So
wow.
We can use it as a manual, guys, and don't be embarrassed.
Well, no, because I think, look, this information that we're coding and sending out and the process and the intention behind what we're doing here is grounded on all sorts of different elements, from ancient history to physics to mathematics. Again, this is, I think it's really important that in the next transmission, something that David had talked about was that there's a musical scale based off of dimensions and certain aspects of the Great Pyramid. So what we would like to do is similar to the manual, the Close Encounters, where they have a very simple sort of like musical sort of tone sequence. Da-na-na-na-na. We do something using a scale from the Great Pyramid, and then as part of that sequence, we also incorporate some type of a mathematic component, the golden. Are we still there? Yeah,
we're here, but okay. We only have 90 seconds left.
Yeah. Okay, that we incorporate some type of a sequence with like the golden ratio of Fibonacci, pi, or something like that. So. Again, if everybody can kind of go and take a look at sort of some of the discussion notes, you can go into a little bit more of some of the considerations. And I think for next week, we'll be able to have a much more concise documentation to be able to group and go over things with everybody.
To
exactly
be
what's
continued. Gosh, there you go. What a packed show. What a wonderful panel. What excellent work, John and David and Thomas. Go download Thomas's PDF. Look at how you might be able to contribute, how you want to participate, whether you're near a sacred site. And we will continue all of this next Saturday when we do part two of How Do You Talk to an Alien? Until tomorrow night, same time, same bat channel. Remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.